Hey, Senator Seekins, Senator Stevens, Senator Ellis, Senator Davis, myself, Bundy. We began today with HB 274, Public Accountants. We will do SB 307 and HB 393, initial hearings on both those latter two bills. And then we have confirmation to move forward for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, State Board of Registered Architects, Engineers, Land Surveyors, and the Board of Veterinary Examiners. So, with that, Senator. Representative Hawker, I forgot, you work for a living.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bundy, my own senator. I hope that was not portending something I don't know about.
Well, I could give you assurances to the negative on that.
Thank you very kindly, sir. For the record, my name is Representative Mike Hawker, District 32 from the Anchorage area. Sincerely appreciate your providing committee time to take up House Bill 274. House Bill 274 is a result of a project begun some 5 years ago by the Alaska Society of Certified Public Accountants along with the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy to continue to modernize Alaska's public accountancy statutes and move them towards what is becoming a national standard that is generally within the accounting profession. The effort to go to a more national standard is what we've been referring to as the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is the draft legislation offered by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, is to create a more of a sort of a standardized level playing field. We're equivalency amongst differing jurisdictions for both education, training, and requirements to facilitate the practice of accountancy in a consistent manner among states. Alaska's CPA statutes were largely drafted about 1962, have really had very little updating since then. So although this bill appears somewhat overwhelming with however many pages it is, the vast majority of what is in this is truly ministerial conforming language, modernizing our terms. As we all know, any drafting conventions have changed a lot in 40 years. However, there are a couple of very substantial improvements in the in moving us towards the international or the national standards. Particularly, we're looking at increasing that really is a direct result of the issues with Enron and a few other places we've seen, increasing the oversight of accountants providing attest functions. That would be auditing functions. We will be making, with this bill, we would be making mandatory peer reviews, which are currently a optional voluntary situation. And again, I emphasize that even though it's an increase in regulation, it is strongly supported by the accounting industry. We are very clearly defining the requirements for interstate or allowing a practice of an out-of-state firm in the state, which currently was a very vague set of provisions. We are also looking at conforming our education requirements in this to that of the national standard, and it actually reduces the year of experience required. But interestingly enough, in conforming our education requirements, we're actually now going to require that CPAs have a degree in accounting. Previously, you could have had a degree in anything, and as long as you could pass the test, we'd give you a certificate, but we sort of think an education in the related field's a good thing. So, Senator, I realize that's a high-flying overview. We do have, I believe, Ms. Lisa Rogers. I'm hoping Ms. Lisa Rogers is here. She is one of the drafters with the Alaska Society of CPAs who could speak for the society, but just ask the committee to consider moving this forward. It is supported by the Alaska Society and the Alaska State Board of Accountancy, sir.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Hawker? I have a question. There was some initial concern, apparently, by Alaska Society of Independent Accountants. Do you know if they still remain or reserve some concerns?
Thank you, Senator Bundy, Mr. Chair. The concerns they had, we did address in the House process when we were at House Finance having our final hearing. We had testimony from the Independent Accountant Society that they endorsed this bill.
Okay, thank you. Also, in the level of consumer protection, we all like to assume that whenever we hire a professional that we're going to get an appropriate and good service. If there is a grievance, though, against someone covered under this bill, Do you know what the route would be if someone wanted to file a grievance?
Mr. Chair, the route would be an appeal to the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy, which has the regulatory authority and the discipline and the authority to discipline members or recognize practitioners, including, you know, up to revoking licenses and all the other provisions that the regulatory authorities have.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Hawker? We do have a couple of people online, if you'll stay with us while we move forward. Lisa Rogers, please, off-net.
Yes.
Good afternoon. If you identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Lisa Rogers. I'm a certified public accountant licensed to practice in the state of Alaska since 1989. My license number is 1277. I've been working on legislative and regulatory issues facing our profession for at least 5 years. House Bill 274 provides a much-needed update and revision to the statutes governing the practice of public accounting. We are endeavoring to gradually conform our statutes to the Uniform Accountancy Act, which was drafted by the National Association of the State Boards of Accountancy, known as NASBA, and the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, known as the AICPA. NASBA is an organization comprised of the regulatory boards in the 55 licensing jurisdictions in America and its territories. The AICPA is a standard-setting body for the profession. Both of these organizations participated in drafting and reviewing House Bill 274. We also held several forums and workshops in the state to develop consensus within the profession before presenting this bill to you. I encourage the committee to support this bill and move it forward for approval, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
You're welcome, and I see no questions at this time. Thank you again. Moving to the Mat Su, Dan Kennedy, please.
Hi, this is Dan Kennedy. I'm a certified public accountant in Wasilla. I have a current CPA certificate, number 763, and I previously served the state of Alaska as a volunteer on the State Board of Public Accountancy. I'd like to thank the senators first for all your hard work, especially on the significant oil and gas issues that are before you, and also a friendly hello to Senator Seekins and Senator Stevens, who I've met personally over the years. I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 274. I'd also like to thank many other CPAs that worked very hard on this significant language change to modernize the state statutes, bring it closer to the Uniform Accountancy Act, and especially thank Representative Hawker for championing this bill in the legislature. This bill was a top priority of the State Board of Accountancy when I previously served on that board. We thought it was most significant to change Alaska statutes to make it more consistent with many other jurisdictions, that being especially there's 40 other states that have adopted similar language to the Uniform Accountancy Act, and accordingly, we would like to pass this bill. As a side note, I was personally in favor in this bill to reduce the experience requirement to become a certified public accountant from 2 years to 1 year, and within the profession, we actually had much discussion and compromise to the language that is in front of you. In my opinion, there is offsetting strengths to allowing just 1 year experience to become a certified public accountant in Alaska. The offsetting strengths are 150 semester hours concentration in accounting with an accounting degree, and also the peer review examination that Representative Hawker just mentioned a minute ago. So in my opinion, a 1 year experience requirement would allow easier entry into our CPA profession than currently exists. Currently, there's a 2 year requirement in order to become a CPA. So that's just to point out to you primarily that the profession within Alaska did reach some compromise, with the language in front of you, and I very respectfully ask you to please approve the bill out of your committee. Thank you very much, Chairman Senator Bundy.
You're welcome. I don't see any questions at this time, but when you said you've actually, a CPA has actually made it easier to get into the profession, it reminds me of my favorite but only CPA joke. A fellow I knew, his brother-in-law, desperately wanted to be a CPA, and the CPA test is an incredibly excruciating test, as I understand it. And this fellow took the test sort of in an Obermeyer fashion, many, many times over and over. Finally squeaked through. He finally passed the test, and he wasn't a CPA for 2 months, and he's saying, "We got to tighten this test up. There are too many CPAs." So, Representative Hawker, you mentioned that in the past there were people who were licensed CPAs without a degree. Now requires a degree. Those people, if they should still be practicing, are they grandfathered in under their old license?
Senator, Chair, as we've crafted this, any changes that we've made here, we've particularly preserved grandfathering for anyone that would potentially have been affected. To the best of our knowledge, there would be no consequences.
And then the question I always enjoy asking, who opposes this?
Senator, to the best of my knowledge, no one.
Other questions? Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. The committee comfortable with moving this bill forward? We have a motion.
Do you want a motion there, Mr.
I'd have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move CS for sponsor substitute for House Bill number 274, Finance, with attached fiscal notes from committee with individual recommendations.
Jane?
Senator Ellis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, I appreciate your time this afternoon.
That brings us to Senate Bill 307. This particular bill is so simple that even my staff can handle it, so I will ask Jane to present the bill. That's another old joke. And then we do have some folks.
It's going to be cut off.
Yeah, you'll notice I don't get any of the candy, so.
Anytime somebody tells me it's so simple, I get nervous.
Yeah. Just a jest. Thank you. Ms. Elberts.
For the record, my name is Jane Elberts, staff to Senator Bundy. Today we are presenting Senate Bill 307 by request. And a little background, excuse me, on SB 307. SB 307 addresses a problem in the landlord-tenant relationship that has become apparent since 2002 after a Superior Court decision was handed down that changed the status quo on how the collection of late rent and late fees were collected by landlords. What SB 307 does is return the notification process back prior to that 2002 Superior Court ruling. So before 2002, including the late fee on the same 7-day notice to quit with the non-payment of rent was an accepted practice. But then in 2002, the court ruled that this was illegal under the law and required a 7-day notice to quit for non-payment of rent and a 10-day notice to quit for the non-payment of the late fee. So in essence, the court ruled that two separate notices then had to be sent to the tenant. Simple, clear language between landlord and tenant is essential. Replacing one notice with two notices, both with different due dates and different amounts, has caused problems, and invariably, these situations have ended up in court. So SB 307 addresses the discrepancy in state law and allows landlords to return to the same 7-day notice requirement for non-payment of both rent and the late fee. That is the overview of the bill. We have online today Bob Maher from the Alaska Manufactured Housing Association, and he would present to you the perspective from the landlord. And I believe we also have Clayton Walker from Alaska Law Offices online and Ed Sniffer from Department of Law. And they will give their testimony and their views on this bill.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Mr. Maher then.
Thank you, Sandra Bundy. My name is Bob Maher with the Alaska Manufactured Housing Association. The first thing I'd like to do is thank yourself and the committee for introducing this legislation. Jane laid out the basis of what is going on here very well. This is very simplistic legislation. To even simplify it further, rent falls due on the first, generally after a 5 or 10 day grace period. If the rent has not been received, a late fee is assessed. After that time, a notice to quit is hung. All we're asking is that the dollar amount of the rent and the dollar amount of the late fee be included on this 7 day notice to quit so that there's no discrepancy in communication between landlord and tenant. Very briefly, I don't know if it's reached your packet yet, but I do have a letter from BOMA, the Building Owners and Managers Association, in support of Senate Bill 307. I won't read it entirely, but the Building Owners and Managers Association has over 12,000 members worldwide, with 108 members in Alaska, and they do support this legislation also. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And is this in any way really making it easier to evict renters?
No, it's not making it easier to evict renters. It's just simplifying things for the courts and for the landlords and the tenants.
And if an eviction notice is served and protested, the courts are still the avenue of...
Right. It all in the state of Alaska, any FED, a forced entry and detainer, is filed with the district court. And they have the judges in district court level have a pretty wide purview to make decisions.
All right, thank you. I'd like to go to George Camp now.
Yes, hello, my name is George Camp, and I manage Diamond States Mobile Home Park. It's a 522-home park here in Anchorage. And we send out several notices to quit because of the size that we have. We can average at least 20 a month in just on the rent alone issue. And we feel that it would be a great advantage because it does add to the administrative end of it when we have to send out two notices, one for the lates and one for the rent. And this has caused a burden because we've had people comment on it in our office about this situation. So it would just make it easier, more clarify it better for everyone concerned. Thank you.
And thank you. Ed Sniffen, please.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Bundy. Ed Sniffen, I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, and I work in the consumer protection section where I have been for nearly 6 years now. And I want to just point out to the committee some of the consequences SB 307 will have. The department doesn't take a position on whether these are good things or bad things, but I feel compelled to sort of let you know some of the perhaps unintended consequences of proceeding under the language of SB 307. First of all, the status quo before the Nakamoto case in 2002, there was an accepted practice, but that practice was illegal, and it had always been illegal, and the Nakamoto Code recognized it was illegal under current Alaska law. And it was illegal because we have two statutes, one that requires a 10-day notice to quit for failure to pay late fees and other surcharges, and another statute that requires a 7-day notice for failure to pay rent. Rent is treated completely differently from late fees and surcharges, and for a reason. Under the statute, if you fail to pay rent, there are specific review requirements the court has to go through to decide if you didn't pay because you didn't get your notice, maybe there were offsets, maybe you had to perform repairs, maybe you had to pay utilities, a variety of reasons. and the court is directed by statute to look at those issues when deciding whether or not to allow an eviction for failure to pay rent. If you fail to pay a late fee, however, there is another notice required, and the failure to pay a late fee has to rise to the level of being a material breach of the contract before you can evict a tenant. And that's the current state of the law. So by combining these two concepts into one notice, you are essentially allowing landlords to evict tenants for failing to pay late fees, when under the current system, you could only do that for failure to pay rent, and then you could proceed to evict for failure to pay late fees, but only if you show that the late fee failure was a material violation of the lease agreement. So there are some subtle consequences here that do have impacts on tenants. One of the ways landlords could currently, under the laws that exist now, without amendment, get around this by just issuing one notice, is to issue a 10-day notice to quit. By issuing a 10-day notice to quit, you could include not only the late fees, but also the late rent, and you could proceed under one notice. It would just be a 10-day notice and not a 7-day notice. If you're concerned about perhaps shortening that time and allowing the late payment fee beyond the same 7-day notice, I think that's perfectly acceptable if that's what the legislature would like to do. But the courts then should be allowed to consider not only the issues that they would normally consider for failure to pay rent under that notice, but in that subsequent hearing also consider issues related to the failure to pay late fees. And those, the standard of review, so to speak, for those two issues is slightly different. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has, and thank you for the time to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, and I don't see any questions at this point. I'd like to move then to Clayton Walker.
Thank you. My name is Clayton Walker. I'm with Alaska Law Offices here in Anchorage. Our firm has represented a large number of the landlords in Anchorage. We processed a number in the hundreds and possibly thousands of forcible entry and detainer actions on behalf of clients. With respect to the difference between 7-day and 10-day notices, I believe the 10-day notice doesn't actually say anything in the statute about it being for late fees at all. It's simply any other material violation of a lease. The other interesting thing about a 10-day notice is that a tenant's only allowed one opportunity in a 6-month period to remedy a 10-day violation. So if they've making the second late payment, at that point they have no right to remedy that circumstance. So having a landlord use a 7-day notice, I mean a 10-day notice rather than a 7-day notice, is actually rather harmful for consumers. The 7-day notice, in contrast, that tenant could be late every month, get the 7-day notice, pay within the 7 days, and they've remedied. They have a right to stay in the premises. Allowing late fees to be included with that, the rent on that kind of a notice would allow them to remedy that indefinitely, no matter how many times they were late. In contrast, a 10-day notice, they would be out the second time that they failed to within 6 months. Also, I don't know that the case that's out there that says, the Superior Court case has not been consistently applied by the courts. Some of the courts feel that the decision was wrongly decided and it actually doesn't have merit to law. And so we actually have a split in the district court with respect to how to handle the issue. So passing this statute, allowing to clean up that issue, would create uniformity among the district courts and how they handle the issue, which will also simplify things for both the tenants and the landlords, both of whom have had problem understanding, well, what is the amount I need to be paying, the rent or the total amount of the two amounts? I'll be willing to take any questions that you may have.
All right, thank you. I have a question. I assumed from your testimony that it seemed as if we were to pass this bill, a person could be chronically late, and this bill might encourage that, where if a person was under the old system simply late twice, that would be cause for eviction. Am I understanding that correctly?
That you are understanding that correctly. As it sits now and as it sat before the Nakamoto case came down, a person who failed to pay rent timely, the landlord could give a 7-day notice and as so long as they pay within the 7 days, they're entitled to stay there. And they can chronically be late, and they can chronically get to stay there. The question with respect to the 10-day notice, if instead you make the 10, the landlord uses the 10-day notice, one, I don't think that they can put rent on a 10-day notice because the
Excuse me, that was my question. Under existing law, with the 10-day notice for a late fee, you said they only get the chance to cure that once every 6 months, so that if they were late twice, they actually, that would be cause for eviction?
That is correct, so long as the court thought that the late fee nonpayment was a material breach of the lease. If they say, well, geez, the late fee is only $50 and rent $1,000, it's not material, so I'm going to let them stay. You're going to have to wait until the late fees have accumulated to some number that a judge will finally find is material.
Okay, thank you. I don't have any other questions at this time. Wayne Stevens, please. Here in Juneau. Mr. Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Stevens. I'm president and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce supports the changes to the Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act to allow for the collection of late fees as contained in Senate Bill 307. I believe this just clarifies and simplifies the process. I believe it is in the spirit of regulatory reform, which was passed last year. Thank you,
questions,
gentlemen, ladies.
Is there anyone else like to testify? This is the first time where the committee's heard the bill, so we'll hold the bill till the next meeting. And Senator Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you holding the bill over. There's probably a little more thought that needs to go into this, and some of that came up in your questions. Could we ask, or could I ask Mr. Sniffen of the Department of Law to put his thoughts in writing and correspond with the committee? Or
that was my thought.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Sniffen, the committee would like to work with you and get your view in writing, if you would share, and I'll share that with the committee.
Chairman Bundy, I'll be happy to do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we'll see if we can address those concerns and perhaps move the bill next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Sniffen heard the other testimony. I think he knows what the goal is of the legislation. He raised some concerns. There may be a way to do this that would satisfy several different goals. So want to work with you on that.
Okay, thank you. We will address this again in the future. We have the initial hearing now of HB 393, the colon cancer screening, and again, as this is the initial hearing, we don't plan to move the bill today. And who would like to present the bill?
Crystal.
This is the person I was supposed to be really hard on, was that? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean for you to hear that.
And, Mr. Chairman, before we begin the public, or the testimony, or presentation, and then the testimony, the fiscal note has come in, and I'm pretty concerned about the one that we just received today. I'm hoping folks can comment on that as we go through, so we don't have to go back and ask them all about the fiscal note again.
One of the reasons I'm holding the bill is so that they'll have opportunity to examine the fiscal note and get back to us next time. Senator Stevens, or you looked like you were looking. Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
For the record, my name is Crystal Novotny for Representative Anderson's office, presenting House Bill 393, which is the insurance for colorectal cancer screening. This is my first time presenting a bill, so if there's anything else I need to do, or please let me know.
You couldn't have picked a better committee.
So I've heard. Current Alaska state law requires that health insurance policies cover screenings for breast, cervical, and prostate cancer. Colon cancer is the only cancer with a recommended screening test available that is not on this list. This bill completes the list, increasing Alaskans' access to all life-saving recommended cancer screenings. Colon cancer, technically known as colorectal cancer, is the second leading cause of death in Alaska and across the nation. An estimated 57,000 Americans die from colon cancer in 2005. Alaska Natives have the highest rate of colorectal cancer in the nation. An estimated 57,000 Americans die. Said that. Screenings for the potential to drastically reduce this number. When caught through routine screenings at the localized stage, the five-year survival rate from colon cancer is 90%. If not caught until advanced stages, when symptoms are likely to appear, the five-year survival rate is only 10%. Colonoscopy is over 90% effective at detecting colon cancer and can remove precancerous colon polyps, actually preventing cancer from ever developing. Screening is cost-effective. National studies confirm that the cost of these screenings spread across the insured population is minimal, and covering screenings also has a potential for long-term savings by avoiding treatment costs. Colonoscopies are required only once every 10 years starting at the age of 50. Medicare picks up coverage for the full range of screenings, including colonoscopy, when a person becomes Medicare eligible. These facts underscore the cost-effectiveness covering for what most people will be only two colonoscopies between the ages of 50 and 65. The promise of screenings in reducing suffering and death from colon cancer is tremendous. The Institute of Medicine reports that the death rate from colon cancer could drop by up to 80% if the majority of Americans were regularly screened. 18 states, including Texas, Missouri, and Nevada, have already adopted similar legislation requiring screening coverage. Alaskans deserve access to all recommended cancer screenings, including life-saving colon cancer screening tests.
All right, thank you. And you may tell Representative Anderson that he does need to move you up a pay grade because you did a good job.
I'll let him know.
All right. Questions? Seeing none at this time, we'll go on to other testimony. If I could ask you to give up your seat and ask Marie Darling.
For the record, my name is Marie Darling with the Capital City Task Force of AARP. You already have a letter of support for this legislation, which we hope, you know, you will carry forward. And some of the information we had has just been told to you, so I won't bother going through all that. Just to make the comment, though, that this screening will save lives, and it ultimately is a savings in health care costs, and we know that that's important when we start looking at healthcare issues. And so we really do support this, the idea. It's definitely needed.
All right, thank you. And I don't see any questions. Emily?
Good afternoon, Chairman Bundy, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society. And I am really happy to be here with this bill having moved this far. It's been something that I've personally been working on for several years, doing research on, and as Crystal mentioned, 18 other states have already adopted this similar legislation. I want to put a couple things in context. I'll let you know that this is not going to get everybody in the state covered, but it's a significant piece. State regulates about 25% of all insurance policies, so it's a big chunk. And I also wanted to let you know that the American Cancer Society is working on the other pieces as well. On the federal level, we have been working with the federal employee health benefit plans, and just in the last couple years have gotten up to now 70% of all the federal employee health benefit plans do include this coverage. In 2001, we worked on the federal level to get Medicare to include this coverage. So we're making a lot of progress getting all the pieces put together. This is one important piece. Look forward to seeing this bill pass. I want to share just a little bit of information. Some people talk about what the cost is of colon cancer screening, and I want to share with you, Crystal talked about the incredible success of screening, that if you can catch this in screening, you can remove polyps before they become cancerous. It's the only screening tool that we have that can actually prevent cancer. And there has also been a lot of research done on how to treat colon cancer. In the last few years, a number of new drugs have come, chemotherapy drugs have come onto the market. The most recent, Erbitux and Avastin, currently cost $250,000 a year, and that's just for the drug, not for any other part of the treatment. So it's something to consider when we're looking at this. We can prevent cancer and avoid these long-term treatment costs, as well as, clearly, the American Cancer Society is interested in this because we can save lives. I want to share with you a little bit from an article from the New England Journal of Medicine that was published in July of 2004. And this was before those last two chemo drugs came onto the market. They were looking at some drugs that had come on in 2002 that were increasing life expectancy for people that had colon cancer. The thing about colon cancer is you don't tend to get symptoms until it's pretty late stage. So you don't tend to get diagnosed until it's pretty late stage unless you can catch it in screening. If you can catch it early on, you can do real well. Later, there's the survival rates are lower and the costs are clearly much higher. In this study, they looked at a near doubling of the median survival achieved over the past decade, which is great that you can increase survival rates. They went from 12 months to 21 months, so we're still talking about a pretty devastating disease here. But that was accompanied by a 340-fold increase in drug costs, and that's just for the initial 8 weeks of treatment. Assuming that an average patient continues to receive treatment until the median time to progression, 8 months of frontline therapy followed by 4 months of this particular drug regimen therapy would cost $161,000. Unfortunately, such costly treatment would not provide a cure, and the article goes on to state, one can only speculate about the relative effect of directing these resources towards screening and prevention. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. If we can get people in, get them screened, remove some of the barriers to getting screening, we can save tremendous burden on our healthcare system and save lives. It's estimated that colorectal cancer treatment costs in the U.S. average $6.5 billion annually. I just wanted to throw some numbers in, since we are in labor and commerce, and the next hearing is HESS, so we'll talk a lot more about health in that one. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have now or as the hearing continues.
Another number, what's the cost of an uninsured colonoscopy?
In Anchorage, I've done some research, and it's in the neighborhood of $2,500. That is not the – a lot of insurance companies have negotiated rates with doctors. That's before any of that takes place.
Thank you. I see no questions. I'm sorry. Senator Allis has a question.
Through the chair, did you have a chance to look at any of the fiscal notes that are coming to our file for the bill?
I have.
Did you want to talk about it at another time? Or?
I will just comment briefly on that. I have looked at that, and we've been talking with some of the folks from the Department of Administration who are here today about some of the assumptions that were made. One of the things that we want to, and I think that Melanie Milhorn is going to be addressing some of that in her testimony as well. One of the things in looking at costs of adding this benefit, you always also have to look at what are the treatment savings. And that's just one thing I'll mention. And then if there are further questions, and I know that Mark Hickey has done a fair amount of research on this issue as well, and he's available for questions if there are further questions later.
Yeah, I'd assume that we'll wait until we get more information so we can discuss the issue more thoroughly.
That would be fine.
Thank you. Mike Ford, please. Mr. Ford.
Senator, thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Certainly.
For the record, my name is Mike Ford, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Native Health Board. I'll be brief. I know you have other people to listen to. I just wanted to say we're totally in support of the bill. We do believe in prevention wherever we can accomplish that. Alaska Natives have a higher incidence of colon cancer than other racial groups. So whenever we can chip away at the problem, we would like to do so. I understand there are costs involved. I have looked at the fiscal note. All I can say is I'm not certain that's reflective of a true fiscal effect of the bill, because, of course, under the active employee plan now, you do have colon screening. It takes place. That is a covered activity. It is different for retirees, of course. But we just want to be brief and say we think this is a great idea, and if you have any questions for us, we'd be glad to answer them.
I don't see any questions. Thank you, Mr. Ford. Mr. Urien. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. for the record, my name is Rick Urien, and normally I testify before this committee as a public employee. Today I'm here as Rick Urien, cancer survivor. I may be a little bit premature in calling myself a cancer survivor, so I'm still undergoing treatment of Avastin that you just heard about. But I am in that group of people with a high rate of survival for only one reason: early detection. I was found to have colon cancer with a colonoscopy last August. And that colonoscopy was within just a year of a previous colonoscopy. So in 1 year's time, I went from no cancer to full-blown cancer. And early detection allows me to be here today. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of the bill before you and ask that you act upon it favorably.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the challenge it must have been to speak, so thank you. Going off net to Frieda Miller, please. Oh, I'm sorry, not Frieda, but Dr. Frank Sacco.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Frank Sacco. I'm a general surgeon at the Alaska Native Medical Center. And I just wanted to add my voice to more about the human costs. I know you've heard a lot of facts and figures of how this makes sense, but I can tell you that having last week taken care of somebody who had an early cancer that was detected on routine screening that was available to them, and they had surgery that's curative, and seeing that person and that family back and then comparing them to seeing folks the next day with, a 52-year-old woman who is basically putting her affairs in order and trying to get family to come from all over the state, trying to deal what is going to affect not just the life of one patient, but numerous other folks, and with economic and, more importantly, tremendous emotional costs. And the thing about this cancer that is so frustrating is that, unlike a lot of other cancers, we can decrease this cancer, we can cure the people that have it, and it can be very frustrating to see folks die needlessly. So I think there's a chance to save some lives here, and I appreciate you taking serious consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Seekins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, what kind of screening does ANS, the Alaska Native Health Service, provide for Native people?
We provide two main things. We do flexible sigmoidoscopy for people of average risk, and if the patient prefers, we can do a colonoscopy, though we have limitations on how much we can offer. Our population is unique in that fecal occult blood testing, the CARD test, really doesn't work in this population for a number of reasons. But we do, and we go out to the field, and we try and offer this at some of the regional health clinics, such as Bethel and Norton Sound, and for high-risk folks, we offer colonoscopy. even doing this, and we've been very committed to doing this, the numbers, as you know, are quite staggering on the number of people who need to be screened, and we still have screening rates below the national average, which is not anything to brag about, even on a national level.
One other question.
Yeah, additional question.
What do you know about the virtual colonoscopy program?
Virtual colonoscopy is something that may be a way to get more folks screened, but unfortunately, when you actually get down to how it works, you know, the articles that are in the newspapers and the magazines aren't quite accurate. For one thing, it still requires the patient to get a full bowel prep, still requires the patient to have a tube put inside them and inflated with air. And then if anything is found, which will usually be about 30 to 40% of the patients will have something, then they still need to have a colonoscopy. So it's not quite the same thing. What we'd hope would you be able to lay down on the table, somebody take a quick snapshot, and they'd say, no, you don't have anything, and you can go. And it really isn't there yet, and nobody has, at this point in time, it's not really recommended for general screening, though it certainly has some specific indications.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and you work at the...
The Native Medical Center.
Native Medical Center. Would this bill impact your clients at all in that are they not provided with medical care outside of the insurance regime?
It would help in that, you know, about 40% of our patients have some sort of coverage, you know, Medicaid, Medicare, or private insurance. And actually, you know, it's not real well known, but the budget for, like, our hospital, over half the budget comes from what we collect, not from the federal government. And, you know, if we can collect more, that means we can give more services. It won't affect me. I'm a salaried employee. I'll get the same amount, but we will have more money available to deliver more care and screen more folks. So it will help some, though it's, you know, it's certainly not the answer to all our challenges.
And you just caused me to be somewhat curious. Because it is more prevalent in the Native population, are there any assumptions as to why that might be?
We're not sure. You know, there's probably an influence of diet and lifestyle things we know that contribute to it, and there's also a genetic component to colon cancer that's more strong than in a lot of other cancers, and so it may be that the gene is more frequent in this population. Also, as you can imagine, there are not a lot of broccoli up in Buckland. The amount of fiber in the diet tends to be pretty low here. With the traditional diets, and that may have something to do with it, but all of the studies that look at the causes and why people are more prone to colon cancer, it's, as you guys have probably read the newspapers, one month something comes out and says don't eat fat, then the next month it says eat it, and then, you know, it's very similar when you look at the colon cancer picture, and that the only thing that's really proven, not dietary supplements or certain specific diets, is screening, because when we screen, we can not only find early cancer, but by removing polyps, we actually prevent cancer. It's different than a lot of other screening tests where, you know, when we screen for breast cancer, we find it early, but we can't prevent it by doing a mammogram. But when we do a colonoscopy or an endoscopy, by removing polyps, we actually can decrease the incidence of this cancer, as well as find it as an early stage, and that's an important thing about this.
Thank you. You just aroused my curiosity, because
sure.
In other arenas, we often hear the subsistence diet is touted as a very healthy diet, but at least in this case, perhaps not so much the case.
Yeah, I think it's it's hard to know. It's hard to know what the exact causes are, and we are trying to sort that out.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We also have one more person testify. Care Tuck, please.
Greetings. Thank you for all your hard work and for listening to this bill. My name is Care Tuck, and I live in Wasilla in District 14. Somebody asked me today why I would even think of coming to testify on House Bill 393, and the reason was pretty simple, because I can. And because I believe that one voice representing many can make a difference. I can be here because I know firsthand that screening and early detection works. I survived cancer not once, not twice, not even three times, but in 10 separate bouts with cancer. Mammograms, pap smears, thyroid ultrasounds, skin checks, and blood work caught my cervical, ovarian, twice breast, thyroid, lymph, and malignant melanomas. Each of them were covered by my insurances and saved, as we've heard today in the testimonies, eventual thousands of dollars by not having extended treatment costs. I can also testify, because I know firsthand about the facts, that colon cancer is one of the leading causes of cancer deaths in America, and screening is cost-effective. My mother did not have screening available, and her colorectal cancer was not caught until later stages. Due to that financial burden, I was taken out of school to help take care of her. She died at the age of 47, and I was only 16. In closing, I want to share one other recent occurrence. Knowing the importance of early detection, having a family history of colorectal cancer, having had colorectal cancer being caught in early stages and surviving over 5 years, I've now hit that ripe age of being over 50. And like you, I've heard all the warnings on TV. I've heard Katie Couric. I've seen the colonoscopies by Al Roker. And I headed off for my supposedly routine colorectal screening in December. I assumed, and we know what assuming can do, that like my mammogram, like my pap smears, like my husband's PSAs, that the screening would be covered. Not. And I did get that bill that they just talked about, that Emily had talked about. And I will be paying that in addition to the increase in premiums and copays and deductibles that I cover and pay. So today, as a voice of a survivor, as your constituent, and as a fellow Alaskan, I will volunteer and work with you, and as a volunteer with the Cancer Society. And I will continue to share these facts and tell my story here to people like you in Alaska. And as I go back to Washington, D.C. in September for Celebration on the Hill, urging Congress and all of our legislators to rally to end suffering and death by cancer by the year 2015. Please close this loophole by supporting House Bill 393. Let's save lives so people like me can continue to be active and work with great legislators like yourself to make Alaska the greatest place on earth. Let's be on the front lines to end cancer, just like we worked so hard those many years ago to end polio, once and for all. Thanks again for your time and your consideration on this bill.
And thank you for sharing your personal story. Is there anyone else here in Juneau like to testify today? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside and bring it up at a future date. Thank all that turn out to testify today. Yeah. That brings before us the report on the confirmation of appointments. We have before us the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and in the person of Billy William G. Andrews from Anchorage and Gail M. Nemi from Juneau for the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. There's Charles A. Leet from Palmer. For the Board of Veterinary Examiners, it's Steve Torrance from Juneau. We will pass these names forward, but this does not reflect any intent by any member to vote for or against any of these people during future sessions. For the committee's information, we will not meet next Tuesday, March 14th, but we will meet on Thursday, the 16th, and consider SB 273, Motor Vehicle Sales, SB 300, Motor Vehicle Negative Equity, and bills previously heard. Anything more to come before the committee? If not, at 2:33, we'll stand adjourned.